This is an ABC podcast.
It's autumn carnival time, a very important part of the race in Canada, and people are busy.
Normal day, you're up sort of between 3:30 and 4. The stable here opens at 4. First horses work at about, I suppose, they're out the door by about 10, 15 minutes past 4. And then you're just sort of direct traffic. I usually get out here probably 5:30, 6 o'clock most evenings, and that's pretty much a normal day.
I buy and syndicate racehorses, and I have been doing that since 1988. We buy and sell probably 20 horses a year, and when I say sell, what we do is we package them up into perhaps 20 shares at 5% interest and on sell to the public.
People come from not just across Australia and New Zealand, but from all around the world. I mean, next week we'll have representatives of entities from the US, Europe, the Middle East, the Far East, South Africa, you know, right around the world. This sale solicits the attention of major investors right across the world, and that's what makes it exciting, but by the same token, it brings a certain degree of pressure with it as well.
Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is The Money. Today, we're having a look at the thoroughbred business. There are actually three autumn carnivals: Adelaide, Melbourne and Sydney. Perth has a winter carnival that began on the 5th of January. Yeah. Brisbane has a winter carnival that begins in about 3 weeks. Both Brisbane and Perth finish at the end of June. In the autumn carnivals, there's a lot at stake. Prize money in Adelaide's a shade under $6 million. For Melbourne, it's $13 million. But Sydney is where the real money is, $41 million, with $9.6 million up for grabs this weekend. A week later, it's $10.3 million, including $4 million for one race alone, the ATC Queen Elizabeth Stakes. Next week also sees the biggest yearling auction in the country, the English Easter Sale. It's quite an industry. Shelley Hancocks, the principal of Hancocks Bloodstock, has been in it for decades.
We know there are about 18,000 foals bred annually in Australia, thoroughbred foals. There's about, say, 34,000 horses in the racing population all the time, and we need that. We need that number of horses because it's basically 7-day-a-week racing in three states at least. There are something like 2,200 TAB race meetings plus another 500 non-TAB race meetings every year. And I think attendances to races in Australia are around the 4.1 to 4.8 million people a year. And a lot of those, over 50% of the attendance is in regional areas. It's not at the metropolitan tracks, which is quite a surprising statistic.
So how many billions does all this add up to?
Well, the Australian thoroughbred industry figures say that the racing industry is responsible for generating over $9 billion of value-added impact into the economy every year. I can remember some figures from 2 years ago where the racing industry is basically the third biggest employer. Now, that just doesn't include just stable staff and secretarial staff, but it includes staff of racing clubs in every state. But it also includes the areas that serve the industry, like veterinarians and their staff, horse transport companies and their staff, people who transport feed and who make feed, and people who make the gear that goes on horses. It's a very, very wide-ranging industry.
Sebastian Hutch is right in the middle of it, and the general manager for bloodstock sales at William Inglis is about to have the biggest 2 days of his year.
To be perfectly honest with you, this is the most important yearling sale in the Southern Hemisphere. This is the sale that when people set out with dreams of breeding a champion, those commercial breeders will set out with the objective of offering their best yearlings at this sale. It's reflected in the success of progeny who've graduated from this sale, and it'll be reflected in the prices realised at this sale next week and historically in prices realised at this sale in past years. It's a relatively small book of 450 horses, but it's very select. You know, there's quite a considerable amount of time that goes into identifying what are perceived to be the appropriate candidates for this sale. That's work that goes back 9-10 months into mid-2018, the work starts in terms of trying to identify the appropriate animals for this sale. and it's then reflected in racecourse results over an extended period of time, because these animals, these yearlings, are considered to be the best yearlings, because historically these are the yearlings that go on and most frequently demonstrate themselves to be the best racehorses.
14 months ago, Inglis moved to its new purpose-built facility at Warwick Farm in Sydney. There's stabling, an impressive sales yard, even a hotel. It all cost $140 million. So how does Inglis make its money?
Inglis makes its money as through commission-based, or entry fees paid by the vendor, and then there's a commission paid on the final selling price.
How much?
8%.
Right, so say you had a year in which you sold 100 million at this sale, Inglis would pocket 8 million.
Yeah, so obviously over the course of an entire sales season, I haven't got a figure for the actual turnover for the 2018 calendar year. I mean, we're only, in terms of sales season, we have a number of sales left to go. We're tracking at a level that means that sales have been satisfactory, but Easter is our big sale. So it'll really define how our year is perceived, how our trading year is perceived, how Easter goes.
So what is a good yearling, a good prospect?
At the end of the day, people are looking for what's an athlete. Some people will want to try and buy a horse and go and win a Golden Slipper, which is the richest two-year-old race in the world, with prize money fund of $3.5 million, whereas there'll be some people here who want to come and try and buy a Derby winner or a horse that might go and win a Melbourne Cup. Obviously, that's something that's getting progressively harder to do, but still, there are horses with genetic credentials at this sale to go and do it. So, you know, people will be here scouting the grounds trying to find that horse. And what makes a great two-year-old, you know, will in all likelihood differ significantly in what will make a likely Melbourne Cup winner in terms of physique. So in the same way that 100-metre sprinters are built in a particular way in humans, they are built in an altogether different way to marathon runners. And while the disparity isn't as stark in the case of horses, it's a good way to try and get into a headspace as to the difference between the two.
That means that if you know what you're doing, you can see a lot very quickly.
Walk is something that's generally indicative of athleticism. So how a horse moves in at a walk, people will like to use that as a guide to how a horse will gallop in his faster paces. So people like to see a nice, athletic, fluent walk generally. But in the case of sprinters who are more muscle-bound, people will be more forgiving of a less fluent walk, whereas in a horse that's expected to stay and run out over extended distances, they like to see more athleticism. So that's one area where the difference can be particularly noteworthy.
Okay, good bloodlines. What do you mean by that?
In some cases, it's about having a good sire and dam, so a good father and mother. In other cases, people will like to draw inferences from history that goes further back through a pedigree. In bloodstock, people talk a lot about a nick, and a nick will generally refer to chemistry between the pedigree of the sire, the father, and the pedigree of the dam, the mother. And the nick will refer to the historical precedent of that cross or that sort of mating having been successful before. So we'll have yearlings offered at the sale next week by a stallion like Snitzel, who's a record-breaking stallion, champion stallion of Australia. There'll be instances where there are mares in this sale that have already had offspring by Snitzel that have performed to a high level. So when a full sibling will come through, people will attach a little bit more significance to the fact that that union has worked well before. Now, obviously, the likelihood is that the union won't produce an identical horse, but people might see similarities in the previous offspring to what they see in this year's yearling, and that may or may not compel them to want a bit stronger. So bloodlines are very important again, but it's just subjective in terms of the significance people attach to them.
It absolutely feeds into the decision-making for yearling buyers, like racehorse trainer and owner Anthony Cummings.
So when you buy a yearling, first of all, you want to buy something that has the potential to run. In a lot of respects, it's just the basic mechanics of it, the shin bone connected to the knee bone connected to whatever, and in the right proportions. And then you like the way they move, and in looking at them, you decide that they're going to be worthwhile. That, in the most part, takes about a minute. And then you've got to go looking for what the faults might be that will slow you down. And depending on pedigree, whether that fault gets in the way of the likely best time for that horse. So if you've got a horse that's got a two-year-old pedigree but has got issues that will stop it from being a two-year-old, well, you know, you're probably not going to go there. But another horse might have the same issues but has got a pedigree that says he's going to be a, you know, three, four, five-year-old. Well, then those issues don't matter. So, you know, you can look at the two horses. They could be identical in all ways in build movement, but the one with the pedigree that matches the timing of the issues that you've got to deal with is the one that you fall into.
Shelley Hancox, who buys horses for her syndicates, is mostly working with smaller budgets, but she likes the auctions too.
I would rather go to an auction and look at 200 horses and then sit around and bid on the ones that I like, and a vet has also approved and had a quick look at their x-rays and their laryngoscope, which is their airwaves. I will sit there through sales, or my business partner, Rod Peacock, will sit there through sales just waiting for a horse that we like, but we know maybe immature, it's going to be good value because for whatever reason, it's not the big sexy horse that a trainer wants, but it's the horse that we know will improve in the next 6 to 12 months and will do the job for us. You can go to a horse sale where the average is 110,000, say, for instance, but we're not buying at that level. We're sort of looking for horses that might slip through the cracks a bit, horses we like, and their conformation is sound for racing, but they are not going to make the 110,000. They're going to make somewhere between 20 and 50,000.
525 now. There he goes. Home for the lead. At 525,000. Last chance. What have been the best buys ever at Easter, Sebastian?
Particularly in recent years, Merchant Navy is a great example. He made $350,000 through this sale and sold subsequently for a figure reported to be in the region of $38 million. And the old adage amongst horse people goes that a good horse can change your address, and it's a great example of how a good horse can change your address. At the other end of the scale, you'll have horses that realise as little as $20,000 and go on to be, you know, the Golden Slipper winner from 2 years ago, 3 years ago. She Will Reign was a $20,000 yearling that won, you know, in excess of $2.5 million in prize money, and subsequently sold as a broodmare to Japanese interests for an unreported figure, but again, it'll have been a seven-figure sum. You know, she was owned by a syndicate of a huge number of people, and to enjoy the thrills not just of her race career but then to have that rewarded through prize money and subsequently the money she realised through sale really is the ultimate experience.
Did you get the list of horses walking the Savo? So there's.
This is The Money with me, Richard Adie. I'm at Leilani Lodge, which backs onto Sydney's Randwick Racecourse and is the headquarters of trainer and owner Anthony Cummings. Actually, just before we get started.
She ran second on Monday.
Hey. What's her name?
Lobster Rock.
Lobster Rock, hello.
She's by Road to Rock. First two starts, she's just sort of learning, and then on Monday she sort of stepped up, still learning, but was much better.
How old is she?
Three.
How many have you got here?
Stable here, full is 57. And most of the time we're around about that number. There's always horses moving around, coming down to the preparations end of a particular stage of education, and then they go back to a paddock somewhere. In the most part, you know, we use Wild Oaks at Camden, or, you know, for longer spells they'll go to Twin Hills at Cootamundra. There are other places, Jazz Common, so that, you know, that we use it as well.
Actually, what do? Is it a matter of getting the horses fit for racing?
It doesn't really take that long to get them fit, but in terms of showing them what to do and educating them and getting them to understand what's being asked of them, that takes longer. To get them strong enough to go along and sort of race and then improve after that race, rather than sort of feel flat as a tack, you know, for a couple of 3 weeks and not being able to go back and do it again in a reasonable time, you know, that's not productive. So you've got to stage your training before you race them so that the race will be constructive to a full preparation. It's about timing, it's about, you know, management, knowing what they like and what they don't. There's all sorts of different accommodation here. They can be inside, outside, they can be in a dark corner, they can be in a bright yard. It's about managing them and their life in a way that's constructive and makes them feel good.
Is it a bit like managing elite athletes with different personalities who can't actually talk to you?
It's exactly what it is.
So how does he make his money?
For us, it's just about winning. You know, we get percentages out of prize money, and that's what makes the stable work.
So there's percentages. How much do you get out of prize money?
Directly from the system, there's 10%. Most of the main trainers, certainly I do, charge an extra 5% on wins. And as I say, that's where I make money. The rest of it just pays the bills.
And there are fees also. If I'm part of a syndicate and we've got a horse and you like the horse and you think you can get the horse to win races, how much does it cost us to bring that horse to you?
Nothing, just pay the monthly bill, but you need to like the horse is the thing. So it's, you know, someone walks in here, everyone here pays the same fee, and it costs you around about 50 grand a year to run a horse.
Is that here, or is that just in Randwick?
I mean, that's pretty much a general figure. You know, we all dress up a little bit differently. Some, you know, have different day rates and add-ons and all the rest of it, and try and sort of compete on a day rate basis, but at the end of the day, you're paying the same money. Like, we all pay the same rent, the same wages, and I think the ratio of staff to horses in most places is quite similar. So, you know, our bottom line costs are not different. So I think if you work on 50, 55 maybe, as a base number per year, that's about accurate.
And what are most of your costs?
Well, it is about feeding them. Yeah, you know, I suppose as a comparison, you know, we basically run a hospital for horses. So the level of care, the fact that, you know, they've got individual rooms, those sorts of things. I mean, it's like a private hospital, and that's an expensive business. You know, horses are. I mean, they're people hungry. They take quite a lot of people to make them work, for riders, for the day-to-day handling, the people that sort of just walk in and sort of tidy their boxes up and clean them out of it, you know, a couple of times a day. So if you can imagine someone being in hospital and the level of care that's required, that's what we do here for horses.
These days, I suppose you can be fairly picky about which ones you take.
People tend not to send horses here that aren't, you know, that have a certain amount of blue sky attached to them. Well, my job as a trainer is to develop the blue sky to try and reach the high value races. And certainly at Randwick, it's easier to do. You're closer to the action in every respect. It's always an easier walk out the back gate here and down a service road to, you know, the highest prize money races in Australia.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adey, and in the middle of racing's autumn carnival, we're looking at thoroughbreds. Shelley Hancock's is around them all the time.
I buy and syndicate racehorses, and I have been doing that since 1988. And at one stage, I had a business where we were syndicating and managing up to 65 horses a year, which now back down to a much more manageable level, where we buy and sell probably 20 horses a year. And when I say sell, what we do is we package them up into perhaps 20 shares at 5% interest and on sell to the public.
Right. So over 30-odd years, how many horses and how much prize money actually?
A lot of horses. I think over the last 30 years, the figures we did at the end of February said we've syndicated 674 individual horses. They have won $19.5 million. They've recorded 1,230 wins, and the total cost of those horses was just over $7 million. So the average cost, $10,500.
Running a syndicate involves jumping through quite a few hoops.
You have to go to the Australian Financial Services and get a dealer's license. Now, even though it isn't really an investment product, it is looked at as such by the Australian Financial Services Licensing Board. So we have to have an AFSL before we can go and advertise horses to the public. And before we can advertise a horse to the public, having bought the horse, we then have to go through multiple steps before we're allowed to advertise. And those involve doing a product disclosure statement, and that spells out in great detail where we bought the horse, how much, the horse's pedigree, if it's insured and for how much, a current veterinary certificate of suitability for racing, a letter from the horse trainer who's going to train it to say he or she is happy to train it, and we must outline any conflict of interest in our product disclosure statement. A copy of any advertisements have to go into that product disclosure statement. Then that goes to the lead regulator in whatever state the horse is going to be syndicated. So it's not a simple process.
So, Shelley, if I was interested in getting part of one of your horses, what would I do?
That involves you buying a share, either a 5% interest or a 2.5% interest, and that will involve a monthly cost, apart from the cost of the horse, which could be anything from $1,000 for a 5% share up to, you know, say $25,000 for a 5% share. And then you have ongoing monthly costs, which would average $180 to $200 each month of the year to pay for your share of the horse. And an average horse in a decent stable in Australia is going to cost about $45,000 a year in training fees, vet fees, insurance, transport, all those sort of things. It's a very wide-ranging industry, actually, the thoroughbred industry.
So that's $45,000 between 20 people?
Yes, between 20 people. If you've got a 10% interest, or obviously the costs go up or go down according to the scale of the share percentage you have in the horse.
How likely is it, though, that the horse will be a winner?
Well, the industry average is about 50% or less. At any one time in Australia, there are about 34,000 registered horses going around. And of those, mainly only about 50% will win a race. Then the percentages slide alarmingly as to how many will win two races or three or more races and how many will actually make it to metropolitan level where the better prize money is, or to stakes level. So by the time you're looking at a horse that might compete at metro level, it's quite minuscule. In fact, would frighten most people away from getting into the industry.
I've heard different percentages for winners, some a lot lower than that. But given the general unlikelihood of it all, how does Shelley make a pitch to would-be syndicate members?
The pitch to them is that it's a fantastic way to have fun if you've got the extra cash to do it. But it's like any elitist hobby, whether it's skiing or power boating or anything, or you know, having a sailing yacht, for instance, they're very expensive hobbies. They eat money, but they don't necessarily return much. And what you get out of a horse tends to be more enjoyment and a social aspect than money. Although, obviously, there are plenty of cases where people do make money out of horses. For instance, in recent times, we've had a horse who won just a maiden race in Queensland, and a Hong Kong interest jumped up and said, we want to buy that horse. So a $20,000 yearling turned into a $400,000 payday for his owners.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Yes, sir. Well, the prize money in Hong Kong is very big compared to ours, so that they can buy a horse with limited ability and it only has to win one or two races and they've got their money back. But look, we do address the people who can only afford to put their toe in the water of racing by running 800 share racing clubs. And those are entertaining in many aspects, both for us and for the people in it, and that they're done for a one-off fee. So you buy a 1/800th share in half a dozen horses trained in different states by different trainers, but it only costs you about $1,350 or $1,400 maximum, no more to pay, and you get amazing level of interest out of those over 3 or 4 years.
I was walking along, minding my business, when out of an orange-colored sky,
flash, bam, alakazam,
wonderful, you came by.
I love looking at horses. I'm quite happy to spend days and days at a sale before the actual sales start, just examining horses. One remembers over the years where the actual stabling box a horse was in at a sale complex when you bought it. I even remember where some of my better horses were stabled the day I bought them. I was talking to some auctioneers a few weeks ago in Sydney, and we were just going back over a lot of the great horses we've seen over the years, and we all seem to have those traits that if a horse makes such an impression on you, you actually remember exactly where it was on the sale grounds the day you first saw it.
It all kicks off on Tuesday here at Inglis, Sebastian. What's going to be the highlight?
So one of the most feted graduates of the Easter Yearling Sale in recent years, a horse called Merchant Navy. He won one of the most prestigious races during the Flemington Spring Carnival a couple of years ago, the Coolmore Stud Stakes, and then went to Royal Ascot and won one of the most prestigious sprints in the world, the Golden Jubilee Stakes. And that horse's full brother is being offered through the sale as Lot 88. He's going to be a very well sought after lot. He's offered through the Sedgino Draft, which is one of the most prestigious farms, not just in the Hunter Valley, but in Australia. Interestingly, with that horse, Merchant Navy was born on the 14th of November, and this horse has an identical birth date. Like, it's a really uncanny coincidence that his full brother, born 3-4 years later, would have an identical birth date. And it's of no significance, only that people just might draw an inference that there's a positive correlation between the success of Merchant Navy and his birth date and the potential success of his brother and his birth date.
So what will he go for?
It was very hard to put a value on yearlings at this stage. I mean, it'll be subject to how he's perceived by the buying bench at the sale. The average price at the sale last year was just in excess of $320,000. You know, the gross for the sale was just over $116 million. You know, there's a lot of money traded at the sale. The book is very concentrated this year, and the market for the best product seems very strong at this stage. Easter was one of the later sales of the year. Merchant Navy, to give you a guide, made $350,000 at the Easter sale. You know, he wasn't necessarily perceived as a star attraction for the sale. But look, I think it's safe to assume that he's comfortably a seven-figure yearling, and quite how far he goes from there, well, it'll depend on how popular he is with particular people, but I expect he'll be very popular.
The KMH is clear. They queued up. Microphone second. It betraying, giving chase. KMH in front from Microphone and Lyron. KMH led all the way. KMH makes Microphone in the slipper and getting up for third in the white cap was Lyron.
I think your two sons are trainers.
Yeah.
You must be both proud and in competition.
Well, I sort of grew up that way with my old man, and I find it, you know, they both worked here at different times, but I'm quite proud of what they've done and what they're doing. And, you know, James had a high spot just recently. Edward will get his turn at that. He's good at what he does. So I'm looking forward to the day where we've got all the runners in a race between the three of us, and we can sort of toss a coin.
That could happen.
Well, I'm hoping it does.
James Cummings' Golden Slipper winner, Kia Michi, was hardly a rank outsider, though she was the least fancied of the six runners from the Godolphin stable. And sometimes a yearling that isn't thought to be that much grows up to be a star.
Probably a mistake to make, allow the exception to become the rule, but there will always be exceptions of horses that are less well-credentialed going on to be successful. But again, that's in the same way in life. There'll be people who appear to be less well-credentialed than others, but for a variety of reasons go on to be more successful or as successful. And that's part of the fun. If it was as simple as readily being able to identify what the best horse was and the best horse went on to be the best horse, well, then it'd be no fun because the most wealthy people would win every time. And that's certainly not the case in this part of the world.
You got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
Thanks to the very busy Sebastian Hutch, General Manager of Bloodstock Sales for William Inglis, also racehorse trainer and owner Anthony Cummings, and racing commentator and principal of Hancock's Bloodstock, Shelley Hancock's. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Adie, and I'm off the show for a bit now while I work on another project. Next week, you'll have Peter Martin and Gigi Foster with The Economists. I'll be back in June.
Man, they said we better accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No, do not mess with Mr. In-Between. Do you hear me?
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.